The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, podcast listeners, I don't do this often, but I'm going to ask you for money right now. Get in touch with my inner Ira Glass. We just got our Lawfare's 501c3 status approved by the IRS. We are trying to rebuild the site. And if you have not contributed to Lawfare, please go to the site and click on that little donate button or send a check to the address on the site. We need user support, and that also means podcast listener support. Thanks.
One of the real ironies of this whole case is that it's actually almost potentially worse for the government that they won this way in the D.C. Circuit. If the government had just lost on ex post facto, then that would have killed all the legacy cases. It would have meant, you know, you couldn't try Bilul, you couldn't try Hamdan, you couldn't try any pre-MCA conduct that wasn't an international war crime. It would leave completely open the question of post-MCA conduct, which is a question that has almost no relevance to Guantanamo. There's one detainee, Al-Araki, charged with post-MCA conduct, but that would have a huge amount of relevance to the potential future viability of the commissions, and that would have to be resolved on a blank slate if and when that came up. By finding a way to basically excise from the case the ex post facto question, Al-Bilul has now become about the Article 3 question. And the Article 3 question applies equally prospectively and retroactively, right? That is to say, if it's an Article 3 problem to try a domestic law of war offense in a military commission, it's a problem whether it's retrospective or prospective. And if the government loses on that question in the panel on Al-Bilul, that's going to hurt not just the legacy case at Guantanamo, that's going to hurt the commissions going forward.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast. It's Bilul Week, and that is the voice of Stephen Vladek, AU professor of law, Lawfare contributor, founder of Just Security, and someone who needs no introduction to the listeners of this podcast. It was a big week at the D.C. Circuit, 150-some-odd pages of opinions, lots of implications. Who knows what it all means? We're going to talk about that today with Steve. We're going to talk about it with Wells Bennett. We may even talk about it a little bit with me. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 84, Bilul, Bilul, Bilul. So let's start with a very basic overview of what happened, what the court did, what the background is, and how the court agreed and divided over the various questions that it considered. Steve, can you get us started? Like, what's the Bilul for Dummies introduction here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best place to start is that the Court of Appeals decided a whole lot, and then at the end of the day, not all that much. And so the key to understanding this case is to realize that the only question the en banc D.C. Circuit decided in Al-Bilul was Al-Bilul's one specific challenge to his convictions based upon the ex post facto clause. So what happened was Al-Bilul is a Guantanamo detainee. He was charged and convicted on three different offenses, providing material support to terrorism, conspiracy, and solicitation. The problem is that at the time he committed these offenses in 2001 and 2002, these were not recognized as international war crimes. Indeed, the government even concedes as much. It wasn't until the Military Commissions Act in 2006 that Congress specifically made these three offenses triable by a military commission as opposed to, say, a civilian court. And so Al-Bilul's first and most significant challenge to his conviction was that it violated the ex post facto clause. Now, to understand why this went en banc, we have to add one more layer here, which is the earlier D.C. Circuit panel decision in Hamdan 2, the case of Celine Hamdan on remand. In Hamdan 2, the Court of Appeals had held that the MCA couldn't itself be applied retroactively. So without reaching any argument about the ex post facto clause, the Court of Appeals held that the statute itself didn't authorize prosecutions for offenses that were not international war crimes before the MCA if they were based on conduct that predated the MCA. So Al-Balul actually reverses that statutory holding and says, in fact, the MCA does authorize such prosecutions. So now we have to reach whether the MCA is constitutional in so far as it authorizes such prosecutions. And that's where things get messy. So what we have in the Monday's opinion is we have a 4-3 split between the majority and judges Rogers, Brown, and Kavanaugh over the standard of review to apply to Al-Balul's challenge to his convictions. What the majority concludes in an opinion by Judge Henderson is that Balul forfeited his ex post facto argument by not properly raising it in the trial court. And as a result, they only review for what's called plain error review. This is basically, you know, we will affirm the conviction unless it is super obvious that the trial court totally got this wrong, that this was a clear ex post facto violation. And the majority then holds it was not super obvious that trying Balul before a military commission for conspiracy based on pre-2006 conduct violates the ex post facto clause. That doesn't mean they affirmed his conviction. It just means they rejected one of his five challenges to his conviction. And in fact, they vacate his convictions for solicitation of material support. So now what happens is the case actually goes back to the original three-judge panel, which is Judges Henderson, Tatel, and Rogers, to consider Balul's other four challenges to his conviction. And all that's been decided is that his ex post facto challenge fails under very deferential review.
So, Wells, what do you think? Do you think going forward, Balul prevails in any of those subsequent challenges, or did the en banc court basically remand to the panel in order to have them affirm on the conspiracy point?
I think that's a pretty tough question. We were just talking about it. There's, like Steve said, it's a pretty narrow decision in the en banc setting, and it's confined to the single question of ex post facto. Now, the en banc court said that he had waived as to that, and that created this plain error review that is so rigorous and so unforgiving from his standpoint. The question is what does that mean on the way back down? I actually am not sure myself. I will say that Judge Henderson, having written the majority opinion, and Judge Tatel having joined it, it does not augur well. But those arguments are ones that he has raised but haven't been considered yet, so we'll have to see.
What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to separate out the four big issues he still has for remand. And so the four questions that the panel is now going to have to resolve, and they've scheduled the argument, I think, for October 22nd, is Balul has a First Amendment challenge to his conviction, since it's based at least in part on speech.
So Balul, for those who don't know, Balul was Osama bin Laden's propagandist. He was deeply right at bin Laden's side in the period around 9/11, but he was not actually charged with the 9/11 conspiracy. He was charged with a conspiracy more broadly to kill Americans, as well as these material support and solicitation charges.
Which are now out. I mean, let's be clear, the material support and solicitation charges are now gone. And so, you know, all that's left is the conspiracy charge. He has a First Amendment argument that part of what he was being prosecuted for was protected speech, which of course begs the question of whether he would even have First Amendment rights as a non-citizen outside the territory of the United States. He has an equal protection argument, which is that the Military Commissions Act, by only authorizing trials of non-citizens as opposed to citizens, violates the Equal Protection Clause. I think those two arguments are a bit weaker on remand, and I think, you know, I would not be holding my breath that those are going to prevail.
But there is one argument that you might hold your breath a little bit more for.
Well, there are two, actually, right? So the other two arguments for the panel, there's an Article I argument that Congress lacks the regulatory power to prescribe offenses against the U.S. common law of war. And related to that, I think perhaps the most significant question for the panel on remand is what we might shorthand as the Article III argument. And this argument basically goes something like this. The Supreme Court has said, it's permissible for a non-Article III military court. So what I mean by non-Article III is judges who don't have constitutional salary and tenure protections and who are military judges. It's permissible for them to hear international war crimes trials. The best precedent for that is Ex parte Curin, the Nazi saboteurs case from World War II. The Supreme Court's never said that it's okay for military courts, for non-Article III courts, to hear domestic law offenses in this context. And I think that's the huge question that now looms on remand. And the most important thing to take away from Monday's opinion is how little what the majority said will bear on that. Because whatever else we might say about Ballul's forfeiture, the question of whether the military commission has constitutional authority to act is what we legal nerds call a jurisdictional question. And so one that can't be forfeited and one that can't be subject to plain error review. So no matter what else happens on remand, the government is now going to have to convince this three-judge panel that there is a separate and as yet unrecognized exception to Article III for domestic common law of war offenses committed by enemy belligerents. And that's going to be, I think, the real key.
So in some ways, this case is all but unanimous, right? Everybody except
Judge Rogers
wants to throw out, vacate the convictions on solicitation and material support.
Well, and Rogers agrees with that. Those are unanimous.
Right. So that part is unanimous. Everybody except her wants to not vacate on conspiracy, but there's a division over whether to remand on conspiracy or affirm on conspiracy. I'm interested. I found this result entirely surprising. I did not find in any sense, the fault lines to be where I expected them to be among the judges. And I'm surprised both at the scope of unanimity and at the scope of division at the same time. I'm curious, Wells, what is this opinion relative to what you expected?
It doesn't resemble what I expected at all. I counted votes in advance of the oral argument, and I did not see them there. And I thought I saw a solid majority for essentially an analysis along the lines of Hamdan II, which would have required an interpretation of the key statute in play at the time of Ballul's conduct, Section 821, or this thing that talks about the laws of war. And the Deputy Solicitor General, in arguing the case, said, well, this case is really about what that phrase means, laws of war. In so many words, Hamdan II had said that means international law and had reversed Hamdan's conviction for material support, because material support was not an offense against the international laws of war at the relevant time. I had predicted that something along those lines would emerge, and it didn't. As a matter of fact, the author of the opinion, who had said that Section 821 was confined to the international laws of war, went on to concur in the majority of the en banc and himself to write an opinion saying that, by the way, when I wrote this opinion in another case, this is Judge Kavanaugh, he wrote a separate opinion concurring in the judgment and partially dissenting, explaining, among many other things that were surprising to me, that, by the way, when I wrote Hamdan II and we were talking about the meaning of this law, what I really meant was, is it means offenses against the international laws of war and other things in this domestic world that have been traditionally tried by U.S. military commissions. There's this freestanding body of law informed by U.S. historical practice, and in Hamdan II, I didn't really mean to exclude that possibility, even though Hamdan II, when you read it, makes that ringingly clear.
And that's
a surprise.
And do you think that that Judge Kavanaugh has just changed his mind and is not owning up to that here, or is there more connective tissue than it seems between his opinion in Hamdan II and his opinion here?
The way he explains it, he does so in a footnote, and it's the structure.
Footnote 5.
Which will become a legendary footnote in, probably as amongst the three of us, it'll be legendary. The footnote is structured in such a way as to say, well, there was this language in one particular part of my opinion when I seemed to cabin the meaning of this statute to international law of war offenses. But I really didn't mean that because...
He says it was dicta.
He says it was not necessary to the result because that passage went on to say that material support was also not established as a domestic law of war offense by the evidence that the government had put forward. The passage he actually refers to doesn't really quite say that. And in fact, other passages in the opinion are incompatible with that. However, the footnote's second portion says, with this, you know, thunderous transition, it says, in any event, comma, the Deputy Solicitor General persuasively argued that Hamdan, too, is under-inclusive in that respect. So I read that as a rather an effort to salvage some manner of consistency between the two opinions, followed by basically a concession that he was persuaded by oral advocacy during the en banc proceeding.
And if I can back up a second, I mean, I think, you know, so that listeners don't get lost in the weeds, the reason why so much of this turns on Section 821, which is Article 21 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, is because that was the only statute on the books at the time of Hamdan's conduct, at the time of Abulul's conduct, that authorized any trials by military commissions. And so to avoid ex post facto concerns, the government has to persuade the judges of the D.C. Circuit that that statute provided relevant authority for these commissions. That's why so much of this fight has been over whether, as Wells put it, the phrase laws of war in Article 21 means international laws of war, as Judge Kavanaugh held in Hamdan II, and I say held knowing that he now disagrees that he held it, or as the majority in Abulul says, under plain error review, that it also includes the domestic common law of war. But what's telling about Judge Henderson's opinion in Abulul is that she says we need not resolve whether under de novo review Article 21 is broader than just international laws of war. And what that means in practice is that that part of Hamdan is still good law. But I think to the larger point here, and Wells is exactly right, I think the reason why so many people, and I'll throw myself in this under this bus, got this case so wrong is because I think everyone assumed that they knew where Judge Kavanaugh would end up. And if you had assumed Kavanaugh was a solid vote to reverse on conspiracy, to side with Abulul on conspiracy, there was no way to count to four. There was no way to find three other judges on the D.C. Circuit who were likely to side with the government. With Kavanaugh on the government side, the key vote became Judge Griffith. And it was fairly clear, I think, from the oral argument that Griffith was the judge most committed to the notion that Abulul had forfeited his arguments in the trial court, and was the judge least interested in reaching the merits de novo. And if Griffith wasn't willing to reach the merits de novo, that would have left at most three judges to reverse Abulul's conviction, Chief Judge Garland and Judges Tatel and Rogers, hypothetically, and three judges to affirm, Judges Henderson, Brown, and Kavanaugh. And I think that's a large part of why we had this fractured, plain error specific, very limited, but very long ruling.
So who won this case? I mean,
yes.
You know, this is like, you look at it and you can say, well, a lot of people expected conspiracy to fall. Conspiracy didn't fall, therefore the government won. There was never a serious question that material support and solicitation would stand. Therefore, the government won. On the other hand, you could say, well, hang on, they lost two of three charges, and they may still lose the third. It's actually a pretty good day for the defense. How do you read it? Who won the case?
You can say that everybody lost something. I mean, we know that, right? If you're a prosecutor and you want more certitude about the offenses in your quiver, you certainly didn't get that from this panel. And in fact, there's kind of an empirical question about how you would use, even if you got, you know, you would need more certainty, but, you know, there's this population of people that are at Guantanamo, and there's some question as to how big that population is, who you would need a freestanding conspiracy offense for. You certainly didn't get the kind of certitude that I would want as a lawyer bringing that case going forward. On the other hand, you have Abulul, who, as you said, he has two convictions knocked out, but not one, and he's a sort of a long-term Guantanamo detainee. So everybody loses something. It's not clear to me who won this case.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say, you know, since the World Cup just ended, I think we're going to extra time, and I don't think anyone's won yet. I mean, if anyone won, I guess the two best candidates are Judge Griffith, who I think was the jurist most invested in keeping this narrow and hyper-specific, and me, because the panel, the case going back to the panel now turns on this Article 3 question, on which at least until now, I think I've been the only person shouting about in the universe. So I don't feel like I want anything. But realistically, Wells is right. I mean, there's, you know, everyone lost something here, and it's really all still to play for, even on conspiracy. I mean, I think this is the hardest thing to understand about the decision is it doesn't even guarantee that the government's going to prevail on conspiracy, because Ballul still has these four existing challenges to the conspiracy conviction that now to be resolved by the three-judge panel. So I don't think anyone actually won. I think, you know, life got a little bit easier for Ballul and a little bit harder for the government, and now the question becomes what happens on remand.
So I want to make a case that the government did a little better than that. Seems to me the government, the first big thing they won was that the D.C. Circuit is not arguing about the integrity of the commissions. You had seven D.C. Circuit judges, and they were arguing about the technical parameters of the availability of specific charges. And that's actually, if your long-term objective is the establishment of the vitality of commissions, you know, the fact that you have seven judges, all of whom are assuming that there's some legitimately triable offenses in this forum, is perhaps subtly a non-trivial thing, and certainly very different from the big balloon question in Hamdan 1, right, where you're really, you know, is this commission allowed to exist? Is kind of so that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, there are at least three votes for the idea that that conspiracy survives, even retroactively. And I think the chances that there is one more vote for that is not bad. Not, you know, obviously a matter of uncertainty, but given that we thought we were operating in an environment in which there may be no votes for that, or one or two, I think the fact that you have three solid votes for that proposition is a pretty substantial thing. One more thing. Ballul, I expected Ballul's conviction to be, on all counts, to be vacated. And Ballul, you know, you're right that he lives to fight another day, but right now he's still a convict with a life sentence, and a life sentence which, given the momentum of the administration toward trying to declare the end of the conflict, the more people you have who you have sentences that will post-date whatever you call the end of the conflict, yeah, that's not a trivial thing either.
So let me start at the beginning. I mean, I agree the government won for not losing. And it's worth stressing that I think, you know, Ian Gershengorn, the deputy SG, and John DePue, I mean, I think they really pulled a rabbit out of the hat here by salvaging at least even this, whether you want to call it a victory or just a non-defeat. But I guess I'm a little more circumspect than you are, Ben, about what this means.
I'm intentionally trying to be provocative and throw an optimistic scenario.
So let me respond in two parts, and then Wells can jump in and fill in all the things I missed. So first, you know, I don't think there's any judge on the D.C. Circuit, and I dare say any federal circuit judge worth his or her salt, who would say commissions are per se illegitimate, because they'd have to deal with Kieran. And as long as Kieran is on the books, there is clearly Supreme Court imprimatur for military commissions, at least for clearly established international war crimes during armed conflict. And so I don't think, you know, if that's all the government had to get the D.C. Circuit to say, you know, then I don't know. I think that's pretty low-hanging fruit. On the vote counting, listen, you're absolutely right. I think Kavanaugh is really the key here. And, you know, switching sides the way he did to make sure that there are now three votes on conspiracy is a big deal. But if we're going to talk math, let's talk math, right? I mean, Al-Ballul was heard by a seven-judge en banc court. There are now 11 judges on this court. And, you know, Judge Srinivasan would be recused from any subsequent proceedings in Ballul's case. He probably won't be recused from all Guantanamo cases. And even if he is, there are three other Obama appointees who would now add to the en banc court. So, you know, Ben's quest for a fourth vote, I think, is at least 1.5 votes short. So realistically going forward, I think this was the closest the government was ever going to get on at least non-international law of war offenses retrospectively. The hard questions going forward are prospective, you know, what happens for conspiracy specifically, and what happens for prospective non-international law of war offenses, like in the al-Iraqi case. And then just the very last thing I'll say before letting Wells jump in, you know, if we're talking about this decision as legitimizing the commissions, and I know Jack Goldsmith wrote a post on Lawfare, I think, on Tuesday about this, you know, let's be clear that the D.C. Circuit, including Judges Henderson, Brown, and Kavanaugh, unanimously held under plain error review that the commissions had no business trying material support and solicitation charges. And so insofar as we're trying to sort of hold this out as a legitimizing win for the commissions, keep in mind that the CMCR had concluded unanimously that it was perfectly all right for the commissions to try these charges.
Yeah, two things on that. The one is just on the legitimating part of it. You know, this round of litigation perfectly resembled the panel in one respect, which is that nobody had anything good to say about the CMCR's review, or I think anything to say about it at all.
Yeah, it's just ignored.
Except in Judge Rogers' dissent.
Except in Judge Rogers' dissent. But and also to the stability point, that's a lot of appellate litigation. If you've counted up, there's a new en banc court, but you need a lot of stuff to happen between now and then. We're not talking about a huge amount of time, but you're still talking about till October to go to a panel, and then whatever kind of appellate proceedings are going to come thereafter, and then maybe, I mean, this is probably, we could talk about it, but maybe if either side in that wants to go to the Supreme Court on this issue. So the legitimacy point, I mean, I think you can kind of sort of quibble about exactly what it does or doesn't say. I wouldn't take it as terribly legitimating myself, but there's, in terms of what the prosecution gets out of it, if you really want this, if you have some action items, if you have people for whom, you know, you give up the material support solicitation, but you want to charge a pure inchoate al-Qaeda conspiracy type charge, and there are people who you think you can bring evidence on that case, you're certainly going to wait until all of that has concluded along the way with three new judges from the Obama administration.
Well, so let's go forward with this. If you are the prosecutor's office at the military commission, how does this affect your charging decisions going forward? Do you look at this and say, well, conspiracy is alive? Do you look at this and say, conspiracy for a completed act is alive and therefore we'll use only that? Or do you look at this and say, I'm never charging anything with the word conspiracy in it again?
Can I elaborate on the distinction you drew in the middle there? Because
yep.
I think our listeners might be a bit lost on that, right? So one of the fights here is the argument that the defendants have been making in these cases is that conspiracy as a standalone offense with no required proof that it was in conjunction in relation to completing a substantive offense is not recognized as an international war crime. That's very different from, say, conspiracy to commit the completed substantive war crime of attacking civilian targets, for example, like 9/11. And indeed, the international criminal tribunals for Rwanda and Yugoslavia recognize something called joint criminal enterprise, which looks and sounds a whole lot like our conspiracy law. The difference is, if you're charged under a JCE theory, you're charged with the underlying war crime, and JCE is just the theory of liability to prove that you're guilty. So if I'm, you know, General Martins and his staff, and I think they're all very happy that I'm not, but if I am, I think what I'm saying right now is the JCE question hasn't been touched at all by the D.C. Circuit. And so if I have a case where I can charge a completed war crime under a JCE theory, I'm going to do that. And we've seen that in the 9/11 trial.
Right. I mean, that's exactly the way they've charged.
Right. They amended the charge in the 9/11 trial to add conspiracy as a theory of liability, not as a standalone offense. And if there are other cases like where they can charge like that, I don't see anything in al-Balul that would stop them. But if I have just a pure inchoate conspiracy with no completed offense at the back end of it, I'm waiting for al-Balul to resolve itself because that's a whole lot of mess to get into.
Two things on that. One is that what was so fascinating, we haven't talked about, I believe it's Judge Brown's separate opinion. We'll get there in a little bit. But something that was so interesting about this is there's language in that opinion suggesting that, I mean, both her and Judge Kavanaugh wanted to push past the question of whether Al Bilulian forfeited his arguments on ex post facto. They said, no, we wouldn't do that. We'd review this de novo, among other things, because they wanted to provide clarity to the government. In her opinion, she says, one of the things that is really important about this case, and there's language all littered throughout it in the majority and in her opinion suggesting the nexus with 9/11, but she says, this we need this to get done and need to give clarity to these people because of the 9/11 case. And in the 9/11 case, actually, they've dropped the inchoate charge and they're going with the JCE theory. That's just sort of thing one. As for how I would handle it, my gut is with Steve on that point, with just maybe a little asterisk, the asterisk consisting of something I really don't know, which is I understand these cases in terms of the law enforcement interests of the United States, and I would, if there's a tremendous interest, for example, I think a lot of people explain the other Capitol Commission case that way. They say, well, there's all of these legal problems dogging the case against al-Nashiri involving, among other things, the coal and these two other planned attacks. But I think a lot of people in the military can say, well, that involved a serious attack on an American vessel and the killing of American service people. And that can at least, you can sort of bring something home to the people to explain, balance that against the legal risks of bringing that case. That, to me, is a sort of an unknown factor with some of these other people for whom you could throw up a conspiracy charge in the shadow of litigation in Bailul. My guess, knowing what we know about that population and about the legal state of play, is if there were some comparable people, we would know about it. And if not knowing about those people, my instincts would be to be conservative. But I sort of bracket it as unknown.
Yeah, I think on this point, we're all sort of in the same place. I can't imagine that. I think it was amazing that the earlier generations of prosecutors in the military commissions charged the Bailul case the way they did. This is a guy who made Mohammed Atta's suicide video, martyrdom video. He could have been charged with conspiracy related to a completed offense. They charged it in the most provocative way they could. And I don't imagine that General Martins or his staff will make that same mistake again. And if this clarifies in the direction of the availability of the charge, there may be a group of people who are vulnerable to an inchoate conspiracy, but not to any other charge. But that group is pretty small. And the only thing I could imagine pushing in a different direction is if a very clever defense lawyer were able to persuade one of his clients to plead subject to reserving this question, to plead to an inchoate conspiracy charge subject to reserving this question for appeal. And I think that would put the prosecution in a very, very difficult position.
Well, because, I'm sorry, Wells.
Well, I was just going to say, to your point about who lost, I mean, one thing we haven't said, and you alluded to it, but I do think it's clear that whatever happens to Bailul, I think you'll have to wait for this all to get played out, but he was charged in this awkward fashion. Who won, who lost? I mean, I'm not exactly... I think this probably goes into what Bailul loses, but it's always been lingering in the background that however this case gets resolved, there's the chance that he would be charged with some sort of 9/11 type crime.
So or just subjected to continuing detention under the AUMF.
Or for that matter, I think the prospect politically and otherwise for that, I mean, it's such a toxic thing that it would be very difficult for them to countenance. But it would be easier from a legitimacy standpoint to say, oopsie daisy, we never charged you with what we really wanted to charge you with, and that's this, and here we go.
But Ben's point about the sort of, I think, the unwise charging decisions that were made in this case, and this is the whole point of the amicus brief that Peter Margulies wrote that Ben signed, right, in this case, was that you could try to resuscitate this had it been charged differently. But leaving that aside, right, one of the real ironies of this whole case is that it's actually almost potentially worse for the government that they won this way in the D.C. Circuit. And let me explain why, right? Because if the government had just lost on ex post facto, then that would have killed all the legacy cases. It would have meant, you couldn't try Bailul, you couldn't try Hamdan, you couldn't try any pre-MCA conduct that wasn't international war crime. It would leave completely open the question of post-MCA conduct, which is a question that has almost no relevance to Guantanamo. There's one detainee, al-Iraqi, charged with post-MCA conduct. But that would have a huge amount of relevance to the potential future viability of the commissions. And that would have to be resolved on a blank slate if and when that came up. by finding a way to basically excise from the case the ex post facto question, al-Bulul has now become about the Article III question. And the Article III question applies equally prospectively and retroactively, right? That is to say, if it's an Article III problem to try a domestic law of war offense in a military commission, it's a problem whether it's retrospective or prospective. And if the government loses on that question in the panel on al-Bulul, that's going to hurt not just the legacy case at Guantanamo, that's going to hurt the commissions going forward. So it's going to mean that the commissions constitutionally are only allowed to try international war crimes, a universe that's a whole lot smaller than the class of cases the government has historically sought to bring.
And how do you handicap the likelihood of that? You've been on this hobby horse for a long time.
Now everyone else is here. What does it look like? I don't know. I mean, I think from the government's perspective, David Tatel is not the judge I want holding the fate of this argument in his hands. I think it's, you know, that bodes well. I mean, it's not that Judge Tatel is a Democratic appointee. It's that he's really, really smart and into the weeds on this stuff in a way that not all of his colleagues are. I think it's a close call on the Article III question. You know, I think it is unprecedented. That doesn't mean it's wrong. I think it is certainly cert-worthy, however it comes out. And so my sense of the matter is that whatever the al-Bulul panel now holds on the Article III question, unless they resolve the case in al-Bulul's favor on one of the other three grounds, if they resolve the case in either direction on the Article III question, I think this ultimately becomes not about what Judge Tatel thinks, but about what Justice Kennedy thinks. I have no idea.
Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Steve Vladek for trekking over from AU. Our music, as always, is performed by that Hong Kong-based Edward Snowden-esque figure, the pianist Sophia Yan. If you missed her concert in D.C. the other day, fault is yours. Share us on Facebook, tweet us, do whatever you have to do to spread the word. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.